Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review, conversations about books, authors, and ideas. Here's the editor of the Book Review, Sam Tannenhaus.
This week, Jonathan Lethem discusses his new novel, Chronic City. Motoko Rich has notes from the field. Frank Bruni describes the life and times of Hollywood legend Elizabeth Taylor. And Gregory Coles has bestseller news. Jonathan Lethem is one of America's most inventive and acclaimed novelists. He has a new book. It's called Chronic City. It's reviewed on our cover by my colleague Gregory Coles, who, this is very rare for us, just says this novel is a masterpiece, a bravura work. He says it is even better than The Fortress of Solitude, the novel that made Jonathan Lethem a household name. I'm delighted that Jonathan's here to talk about his book. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, congratulations, first of all. It's not often you get a review like this. What is the sensation you have when you're handed a cover review like this and you're making your way through it? Are you sort of asking yourself, I hope he gets it right, or is he seeing things that you hadn't thought of? How do you read it?
Well, you know, this may just be a form of sort of emotional displacement, but I think first of the happiness of my editor or publicist. I care for them so much by now. I've worked with the same people at Doubleday for a long time, and I just know they're sweating to make this thing happen. I did my work. I wrote the book, and time is going to do what it wants to with those results, but they've got a book to put across. They've got booksellers to excite, and suddenly they've been given this incredible tool, and I just feel such relief on their behalf. Then I read the thing. Most times, if someone's taking the care to write a long piece, they're going to say some things that surprise me, delight me, and they're also going to say some things that bewilder me or are disenchanting. But it's the short reviews you really fear. It's the 300-word pieces that try to handle, you know, 3 years of your life, 400 pages of effort.
In a few sentences.
Those are the ones where you tremble in your boots. When someone's written a long essay, they're usually engaging with what you've done, and that's all you can wish for, and that's what you want, is to have someone really read the thing, really spend time inside this, you know, kind of world you've spent all this time propping up.
Well, let's talk about the world you've created here. You're kind of known as one of Brooklyn's laureates, but this is really a Manhattan novel. It's maybe not the Manhattan most of his experience day to day. So tell us what you've done here.
As an outer borough kid, I had a strong relationship to Manhattan. I projected all sorts of things onto that island. It was, you know, a place of aspiration and fantasy and resentment and possibility. And like Saturday Night Fever, it was kind of the place I wanted to get. But I also, because I was a New Yorker, I inherited this double feeling of pride and proprietorship. It was my city, too. I could claim it. Eventually, I did sort of make Manhattan my own. I got there in high school, and I began to explore it and make friends who lived in various parts of the city. So it's very familiar to me. And it wasn't that, you know, for me, that uncanny a leap to want to write about it. I suppose the Upper East Side may seem disconcerting to some people. But, you know, what I love about that part of the city is it's got a doubleness. There's the glamour and the power and money of Park Avenue and Madison Avenue and the access to the park and the museums. But then it's as though the whole thing tilts on a funny plane towards 3rd and 2nd and 1st Avenue. And there you get into a very homely kind of backwater part of Manhattan. It's actually one of the places that's changed the least from when I grew up. It reminds me of the 70s over there.
It hasn't changed at all. I came to New York in the late 70s, and 2nd and 3rd Avenue don't look very different.
It's a sort of scuffling kind of place, totally unfashionable, and with a lot of entrenched residency, people who've been living in the same apartment for 30 or 40 years or even somehow inherited rent control from their, you know, dad and kept the place. You know, it's like a haven, and that's the Upper East Side I know through my friends, and I wanted to try to bring it to light a little bit.
Well, you've got two characters here who are having inventive and sprightly conversations, and tell us who they are.
The narrator is Chase Instedman. He's a kind of a washed-up, one-time TV star, you know, who's living off residuals from a mediocre 80s sitcom, and he was sort of a Michael J. Fox, kind of a precocious, bratty, fresh-faced kid, and people still remember him and recognize him, and he's never going to escape this fate. And he feels sort of hollow, feels sort of fake. He's a social token. He's invited to dinner parties and makes, you know, makes page six every once in a while for doing nothing particularly at all. And he runs into and becomes friends with a kind of icon of gritty authenticity, but to a ridiculous degree, a guy named Perkis Tooth, who's a cult critic. He's a figure from a vanished kind of downtown era of punk rock and performance art. And he used to not only write reviews for zines and for the Village Voice when that was still kind of hip thing to do, but he also would just put up broadsides all over town. So he's sort of a cult figure, at least in his own mind. Very few people remember him. And he is completely a ruin as well. He's paranoid, self-obsessed, physically falling apart, addicted to marijuana, if you can be addicted to marijuana, and completely unpleasant and yet irresistible. And Chase, who's kind of a soft-hearted follower, falls in with him and finds that despite all of Perkis's unpleasantness, that there's something about him that he can't shake. And in fact, he wants to rescue Perkis from himself.
And meanwhile, there are strange things going on in Manhattan, the borough of Manhattan.
Yeah, the backdrop is a kind of end times Manhattan, where it's as though the island has detached from the rest of the city and from the mainland of the United States and floated off into the ocean and is suffering all sorts of strange effects. The weather is altered and animals are behaving strangely. And there's the feeling that the city might have died at some point and is now a kind of zombie or vampire version of itself. It's not quite a living Manhattan.
You're quite celebrated for the many influences you draw on, many from pop culture, some from the world of comic books, science fiction. But you're also really a traditional narrative writer, very character-centered. You write buildings, roman in many ways, stories about coming of age and growing up. How do you do all that together?
I feel grounded in the traditional novel, the great masters like Dickens and Balzac and on from there. Character, story, that's what for me makes fiction work, and I'm very, very committed to that stuff. But I'm telling stories about people like myself, finally, living in the chaotic mediascape of the present day, where vernacular culture and internet culture and pop forms, rock and roll, comic books are all floating around in our heads. They're all part of the texture of our lives and our world. And the cities we live in are, you know, billboarded with stuff. There's language, there's cartooning, there's graffiti everywhere you look. You don't live in the 19th century, you live in the 21st. So I'm doing my kind of traditional storytelling, the only kind I can imagine doing, because I love the art of the novel so dearly, and I'm such a dedicated student of the novels I love. But I'm doing it, as it seems to me, inevitably, a 21st century person must do it, contending with what it feels like to walk around this world.
Thanks a lot, Jonathan Lethem. That's Jonathan Lethem, whose new novel, Chronic City, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review. Motoko Rich is here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Motoko.
Hey, Sam.
So some of the retailers, the heavy hitters, are going at it. Is that right?
Absolutely. Well, we've known for a long time that although everybody has the romantic ideal of the small corner bookstore as the place one goes to buy books, that some of the big players like Amazon.com, Walmart, and others have been big players. Costco, for example, are big players in the book market. That a lot of people buy their books at these big chains that don't necessarily specialize in books. I know Amazon started out as a book retailer, but now you can buy diapers, food, toasters, whatever. In any case, it all started when Walmart, which was trying to make a name for itself in the online world, offered 10 potential bestsellers, likely bestsellers, for $10 if you pre-ordered them online at Walmart.com.
So $10 a piece.
$10 a piece. And we're talking big names here. Stephen King, John Grisham, also the Sarah Palin memoir, the latest James Patterson in the Alex Cross series. Amazon saw this. They matched the price. Walmart came down to $9. Amazon matched again at $9, so Walmart started playing the penny game and went down to $8.99. Then, a few days later, Target jumped into the game and matched the $8.99 price, so Walmart has now got them down to $8.98. So we are talking about a race to the bottom here.
How does that affect the original book publisher? Are they selling those books to these big stores for the same prices?
For now, the sort of immediate knock-on effect on the publisher is nothing, because they're still selling the hardcover book to these retailers for the same price they always have, which is, so say the sticker price on the Stephen King book is $35. They get half that price from the retailer. So the retailer is taking the loss. But the point that a lot of publishers and analysts were making to me, and authors included, was in the consumer's mind, you're devaluing the book. So now in the consumer's mind, they think, well, if I can get a Stephen King hardcover for $8.98, why should I pay $25 for some new author I've never heard of? So the real concern to the publishing industry is that this is the beginning of the end, as it were, that the value of the book, is the hardcover, is no longer the sort of $25 to $35 that we have all grown accustomed to, but now less than $10.
And can they afford to produce books that sell for so little and then still make a profit themselves?
Well, the publishers say they can't. I mean, obviously, there are lots of structural things about the business that could change that we're seeing sweeping through all media industries, that we have to totally rethink the way we produce and our cost structure, and happening here in the newspaper industry as well. But the question is, at what point, you know, it seems to be a race to the bottom.
Thanks a lot, Motoko.
Thanks, Sam.
She's one of the last of the great old-time Hollywood icons, Elizabeth Taylor, who is the subject of a new biography. It's called How to Be a Movie Star, Elizabeth Taylor in Hollywood. It's by William J. Mann and reviewed for us by someone who knows a lot about style and glamour, Frank Bruni, who's here to talk about it. Hi, Frank.
Hi. I'm here holding down the style and glamour for it, I guess.
Someone's got to do it. Yeah. So Liz Taylor, she was this exquisitely gorgeous creature. Was she much of an actress? What case does this author make?
Well, you know, one of the most persuasive cases that this author makes is that she was one hell of an actress. And, you know, it's a case that, as I said, is persuasive when you go back through it and you really look at some of her work, when you look at some of the chances she took along the way. I mean, time and again, she took roles that no one thought she would be quite up to.
For instance?
Well, I mean, I think the ultimate example of that would be Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which won her second Best Actress Oscar. Now, I mean, the Oscars have a lot of politics running through them, a lot of glamour running through them. But when you go back and you look at the number of nominations she received and then the number of victories, too, I mean, that's the mark of someone who certainly had at least a modicum of acting talent. And in her case, it was more than a modicum.
And huge box office attraction, right? She was one of the handful of really big name.
Absolutely. You know, for that certain period of time. I mean, it took her, you know, the book kind of refreshes your memory or re-educates you on a whole bunch of things. She was a star early on with National Velvet, but it actually took a number of years before she would land in those surveys from, you know, box office people of top 20 draws for the box office. It was a career that she built very steadily and very determinedly over time.
And her great period was when? Which decades?
Oh, you know, I having even read the book, I don't think in decade terms. I mean, I think her big period was the 50s and 60s. I mean, those two decades. But it's funny, as you ask that question, I kind of think of it in terms of which clusters of movies, not when they came out.
So what are some of the other great films?
You know, I mean, she was in Giant. She was in, you know, I always forget the title because it was based on Dreiser's An American Tragedy, but A Place in the Sun.
Place in the Sun,
and
wonderful.
And I think that was probably her big breakout in terms of people realizing this woman has some acting chops. You know, later on there was A Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, and that was another one of those moments where people thought, can Elizabeth Taylor be ferocious enough? Can she, you know, be loud, you know, almost feverish enough to play a part like that? It turned out she could, and she, in fact, I would argue, probably introduced Tennessee Williams as a playwright to more Americans, you know, than anyone who ever wrote about Tennessee Williams or any producer who ever mounted his theatrical productions, because she was in a number of those films based on Tennessee Williams plays.
And the life, also Taylor's life, tumultuous, many marriages.
Yeah, well, I mean, she's. Lovers. I think if you do a search on Elizabeth Taylor, you find her more often as a butt of jokes about serial monogamy or whatever. You know, one of the most interesting passages of the book, in fact, I think involves one of her most closely watched transitions from one man to another, which was from Mike Todd to Eddie Fisher. Mike Todd died. She ended up with Eddie Fisher. And, of course, that was the famous, famous Carrie Fisher still does a lot of her stage show about it today, the famous migration of Eddie Fisher from Debbie Reynolds to Liz Taylor. And one of the reasons this is the most one of the most fascinating passages of the book is, you know, people who remember it in shorthand just remember Elizabeth robbed this man from Debbie Reynolds and poor, poor, hapless, luckless, innocent Debbie Reynolds. The book shows in quite a bit of detail how Debbie milked that situation for public advantage and would kind of wait till the photographers were assembled on her lawn to come out of the house with little Carrie as, you know, clutched as tightly to her bosom as possible. Debbie Reynolds was no simpleton.
So this was classic tabloid fodder, is that right? And it's no internet, no cable, but lots of newspapers, some television, big-time gossip columnists, yeah, and Elizabeth Taylor's right there.
Yes, it's a good reminder reading this book that the Angelina Jolie dramas of today, the Britney Spears dramas of today, they all have precedent in just about any 2 years of Elizabeth Taylor's life. And one of the cases the book makes is that she, both through the melodrama that was genuinely manufactured in her life and through her sense of when you needed to throw a curveball at the public to keep their attention, she sort of showed people how you become what Maureen North said about her, the Madame Curie, a fame extension.
And what about the marriage to Richard Burton? Much on that here?
There's quite a bit on that, especially as regards the filming of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? What you see there is really sweet, because here's a woman who a lot of her marriages seemed, you know, seemed to be on shaky ground. They seemed media driven. They seemed calculated. And when William Mann describes her and Burton in Making Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, he shows that for her to play a part where she was aged prematurely, where she dropped her vanity, you know, the way Nicole Kidman would do later for a Virginia Woolf-related movie, The Hours, she needed a lot of support and encouragement. And Richard Burton comes across as a very nurturing muse for her in that era of her career.
Thanks a lot, Frank. It's Frank Bruni who this week reviews How to Be a Movie Star, Elizabeth Taylor in Hollywood by William J. Mann. Gregory Coles joins us again with bestseller news. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
What's there on the list this week?
On the fiction side of things, the biggest book is probably Jeanette Walls's novel, Half Broke Horses, which is a fictional retelling of her grandmother's life.
And Walls wrote the very successful memoir.
The Glass Castle.
The Glass Castle.
That's right.
Here she's taking some of the backstory of that, but actually presented it as in fictional form.
Well, The Glass Castle was the story of her childhood, and she had a very unconventional childhood because her parents were pretty much crazy. They subjected those kids to some horrible conditions. And so in Half Broke Horses, she takes it back a generation to see how her parents might have turned out the way they did. And it's really a look at her mother's mother, who was an unconventional woman herself, a real free spirit.
And yet written as a novel.
It's written in the first person. And so it really gets at her grandmother's life. And there's only one new book on the nonfiction side of the list. It's Madeleine Albright's Read My Pins. She's the former Secretary of State under Bill Clinton, you'll remember. And this is actually her fourth book to make the list. It's kind of an illustrated memoir about how she used her jewelry collection as a form of statecraft and diplomacy.
She's serious?
She's serious. She would pick pins to signal her mood before she met with foreign leaders or to reflect the occasion. So, for instance, she's been touring everywhere to support this book, and she recently told a crowd in Miami that if things were going well in the discussions or negotiations, she would wear balloons or butterflies, and if they weren't, she would pick snakes or spiders.
Wow. So this is our former Secretary of State, eh? This is how she conducted her diplomacy. So has anyone sort of gone back through the record to test her accuracy on this?
I don't know if they have. It actually started when she was the ambassador to the United Nations, and she denounced Saddam Hussein at his weapon program. And he published a poem in a state-run newspaper afterward calling her an unparalleled serpent. She realized that she had a snake pin, and she wore it to her next meeting with Iraq. And it took off from there.
Well, I'm going to be watching Hillary Clinton's jewelry more closely, but I wonder what Henry Kissinger wore when he was meeting
You'll remember there was a flap about Barack Obama wearing a flag pin.
That's right. During the campaign, that was sort of a big deal.
That's right. He decided to stop wearing them. He decided it was a hollow political gesture, and some people took him to task for that. Well, Madeleine Albright's last bestseller was called Memo to the President-Elect, and it was advice to Obama before he came into office, suggesting how he might restore America's credibility. She doesn't mention flag pins anywhere in it.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. Join us again next week on Inside the New York Times Book Review. Remember, there's more at our website, nytimes.com/books. For the New York Times, this is Sam Tannenhaus.